No careers advisor suggested to me that you should be a futurist, but I sort of found my way into it. And a really good branding guy sat me down, we had about 5 pints, and he went, "You're an applied futurist, that's what you should call yourself." In the first 6 weeks, LG, Nikon and Sony Pictures all rang up and said, "Oh yeah, we need a futurist, could you come and do some work for us?"
In their everyday life, why should they be thinking about the future?
Human beings are inherently short-termist. We've evolved over millions of years to deal with what's in front of us. It's how we stayed alive. Yeah, we're worried about where's our next meal coming from? Is that big cat going to eat me? We have stripped all the friction from a lot of aspects of commerce and innovation. I started my first business in 2005. It took me 6 weeks and 2 meetings just to get a bank account. Doing my accounts was a manual nightmare because there was no zero or free agent or anything like that. Running a business was so much harder 20 years ago than it is now, and particularly founding a business and bringing new things to market. But actually bringing new ideas to market is much easier than it was now. Those ideas move much more quickly, and there are many more of them because of this lower friction. So the result is that if you are focused exclusively on the now, you are always going to be running to keep up. Climate change is going to be a big issue. It's not a species killer. It's not going to wipe us out as a species, but it is going to put cities underwater. It is going to disrupt crop production. It is going to make water a scarce resource in places.
Tom Cheesewright, thank you for joining us on the We Ever Meeting podcast. How are you?
I'm good. Well, I'm almost good. I've got the You're Christmas lurgy, but other than that, I'm great.
It's awful. Well, you're fighting through it for us today. Thank you for joining us. I'm going to hit you with a giant question, and let's see where we land, Tom.
Go for
Who are you, and what problem do you solve?
So I'm Tom Cheesewright. I'm applied futurist, and the problem I solve is that people aren't very good at thinking about the future. It's not something that we're often trained to do. Weirdly, it's not something that comes up in a lot of even sort of management training. To think about the future beyond the bounds of the usual annual report, annual budget, to actually break out of the bounds of the day-to-day, take the blinkers off and think about what might be either in the near term, so the next sort of 2 to 5 years, what could be then, or in the long term, the next, you know, 10, 25, even 50 years, thinking about the long-term objectives for you, your organization. And so I help organizations around the world do that. If you'll forgive a few name drops, sometimes big corporations, people like Pepsi and Meta and Google and Ford, and sometimes bits of government like NASA.
Nice. Okay. And then when me and Zach went to school together, and when we were at school, you could be, you might aspire to be a footballer, a pop star, a teacher, a lawyer. On the list of jobs, I never saw a futurist.
So no.
How do you become a futurist? How did you get there?
So, I mean, I have going back to my school days, I have a book to blame, actually. This is actually, I picked this up in a book fair in 1981, which gives you a clue to how old I am. Although I was only 3 at the time. And I was attracted by the spaceships on the front of this book, the Usborne Book of the Future. And it taught me at a very early age that it was somebody's job to do this, not to think about the future in terms of writing science fiction. Although obviously I was obsessed with, you know, Star Wars and all of the science fiction of that age. But actually to do it for real, for practical reasons, to think about on behalf of governments what the future might be like, or on behalf of companies what the future might be like. So I've always known from a very young age that it was a possibility. Obviously, as you say, no careers advisor suggested to me that you should be a futurist. But I sort of found my way into it. I started a blog, as lots of people did, in about 2006. Named after that book, and not long after that, through some weird coincidences, ended up on the radio talking about technology in the future, and started doing a lot of broadcasting. And then about 5 years after that, 5-6 years after that, I got sort of kicked out of my own tech startup. I took what I like to call an assisted leap. I jumped, but with the hand of the investors firmly in my back, giving me a good old shove out the door. And I had to find something else to do. And so I had this blog that I'd been writing pretty much fortnightly for a long time. I had the radio stuff that I was doing. I had a little bit of public profile. And I had old clients who I'd worked with in the past coming back to me and saying, "You're doing this sort of future stuff. Could you come and help us think about this or that?" And so, you know, I put this website up with the help of a brilliant friend of mine, a really good branding guy who sat me down. We had about 5 pints and he went, "You're an applied futurist. That's what you should call yourself." And we threw this website up. And in the first 6 weeks, LG, Nikon and Sony Pictures all rang up and said, "Oh, yeah, we need a futurist. Could you come and do some work for us?" And yeah, I wouldn't say it's been plain sailing ever since. It most certainly hasn't. But that sort of set the tone, set the tenor for what the business was going to be and what the demand was going to be and what the clients were going to be, honestly. And I had no idea what I was doing then. I mean, I really was making it up as I went along. But, you know, very quickly started to realize how you do it, that it's about process and practice and method, that there are no crystal balls, unfortunately. And you really have to sort of learn these structured thought processes and storytelling processes in order to do it.
And those companies, Tom, that are reaching out to you and they're saying, "Help us think about the future," where are they going wrong? What are those symptoms of the errors they're making?
Well, the really interesting thing is they generally come for one of two reasons. One of three, actually. The first one is, what's your policy on swearing on this podcast?
Swear as much as you want.
The first one is the oh shit moment, right? So the oh shit moment is something's just happened. We didn't see it coming. Why didn't we see it coming? And can you come and help us make sure that we do see the next thing coming? So that's generally coming in and doing a bit of foresight for them. So I'll come and do some, you know, 6 weeks research, come and do a report to the board, but also I'll quite often do some management training. So I'll go and teach the leadership team how to think about the future so they can build it into their operational practices. So they're always scanning the near horizon to avoid any more oh shit moments. The second thing that happens is they're really excited about something, but they don't have the tools to explore it because it's not something that you can go and buy research reports about yet. Or, you know, they can't just go to a PwC or a McKinsey and say, "What's the state of this technology or this culture?" or talk to a lobbyist about what the future policy looks like. It's just a bit further out than that. So they need a framework for exploring this possibility and this opportunity. And that might be things like, we know this new technology is coming out of the labs in a few years. What impact do you think it will have on our industry if it works as expected? Or it might be something really practical, like we can see that the way that people snack is changing. Can you help us to explore the trends so that we can develop new snack products in the future? Yeah, really, that's a real example, which I've worked on a couple of times over the last couple of years. The third thing they come to me for is much more, I call it the jazz hands work. Which sounds dismissive, and it's not meant to be, because actually this work can be really good fun. But sometimes marketing agencies or brands or marketing directors come to me and say, "Look, we haven't got an awful lot to talk about next year, and we need to do a marketing campaign to engage with our customers and our prospects, and we'd love to talk about the future. Can you help us talk credibly about the future of X?" And X could be all sorts of things. I've done, you know, super yachts, supermarkets, you know, pizza, all sorts of things. And that generally ends up being, you know, a bit of research, maybe a bit of consumer research as well. You know, press release, a report, maybe some AI generated images to go with it. And quite often me spending half a day in front of this microphone chatting to the media for some interviews. And then sometimes it ends up in some telly bits as well. It's quite frivolous. It's very marketing focused, but actually it's generally quite effective and it's really good fun as well.
Fascinating. Where do you tend to start then? Where's the starting point to get someone to challenge their own beliefs around the future?
So it depends on how far out they want to look. And that really is the determining factor in terms of what tools you use to look at things. If anybody watched Loki, there were lots of illustrations of this in the Loki series of the timeline. And as the timeline goes further out and further out, it branches and branches and branches. So if you like, in the near future, there's a relatively limited set of possibilities. You know, outside of a meteor strike, and actually we're pretty well sorted for meteor strikes. We're tracking all of the things that might come and be a planet killer these days. And we've even got pretty good plans for knocking them out of the way. So not too worried about that one. But outside of those really unexpected events, there's a limited number of ways the world's going to go in the short term. You know, you've got good evidence about the way human beings behave, about policy, about economics, about technology, about culture. So you can take all those bits of evidence and split them to what we call pressures and trends. So pressures are things that are like pent up demand for change, like frustration, what pisses people off, winds people up, slows people down, makes you less profitable than you should be. And then you've got trends, what's coming in that could unlock change, new cultures, new ideas, ways that other industries or countries are doing things, you know, new bits of science. And when those two come together, that's where you get big changes. And so if we're looking at the near term, we look at those, what we call intersections between pressures and trends. If we're looking further out, we generally, it's about storytelling, but really structured storytelling. You can't just go, you know, pluck an idea out of your head because it might not be very useful. What you've got to do is identify the most important, if you like, the most important metrics, the most important influences on a particular domain or business. So if we were doing logistics, like the future of transport, maybe it's energy prices, right? So we do two ends of a spectrum. What if energy is really, really expensive in 25 years? What if energy is complete, nearly free in 25 years? And then you take another two as well, and you plot those on a different axis maybe, and you come up with a load of scenarios like climate change is really, really bad, but energy is really, really cheap. Climate change is really bad, but energy is really expensive. And you've got kind of your four different scenarios. And we plot out those scenarios in lots of different ways. Sometimes we just plot a baseline and go, okay, if all the trends currently continued into the future exactly as they are, and then we bend those trends in different ways to create different scenarios. And then we tell stories about those scenarios. And we say, okay, if the world was like this, what would you do differently in the future? And more importantly, what would you do differently now to prepare for that possible future? And you start to map back from this, these different stories of the future to say, okay, look, across three of these different scenarios, we've decided we'd make the same change now to prepare for it. That's probably a good thing for us to be doing anyway, because it's going to prepare us for a range of different scenarios. It's probably a good thing to build into our strategy. And that's really the most important bit about thinking about the future. Thinking about the future is really good fun, but it's not very profitable unless you actually act on the things that you realize are going to be different. And a lot of foresight work really falls down at that point. And that's why I use the term applied futurist. Like, I'm not a science fiction author. Sounds like great fun, actually. Maybe I might be at some point. But I'm here to actually help people make change based on what we see.
I love it. I'm inspired. So it feels like when you're thinking about the future and if you're working with different clients, there's probably the best place to start is having a few different scenarios and then kind of trying to tie them all together, which clears it up. So we're a big lover of questions, and it feels like one of the big questions are like, what if this, then what? I guess for people listening to this, if they're trying to be a futurist for their own business, what are the questions that they should be asking themselves that cover any sector, any industry? What are the agnostic questions that people should be asking?
So I always try and teach my clients to use that intersections process, because yeah, every now and again, you can go and do the blue sky thinking, the scenario planning stuff, but that's quite resource intensive. Like, it takes a lot of people a lot of time to do it well. Whereas the intersections process, I reckon you can do with 1% of your time. So if you carve out one day every 6 months, you can do that process for yourself. That'll give you a really good view of what the big things you ought to be looking at are over the next 6 months, because they're going to happen in the next 2 to 5 years. And the questions you ask are, first of all, take out for coffee or beer your colleagues, your customers, your partners, your peers, and ask them what's pissing you off, what's winding you up, what's slowing you down, what makes you less effective, less productive than you could otherwise be. You know, what really frustrates you? And the great thing about those questions is people love to complain, right? It is, especially if you get a beer in them, it is cathartic. They will just let go. They will reel off. And they might be a bit nervous about it if they're complaining about you. But you know, generally, if you give people an opportunity and you're really frank about it, say, just let go, just release it. You know, let all the pain out. That catharsis is really nice for people. And you learn an awful lot. And I really like, if I'm doing this as an external consultant, I really like to do this at different levels of the organization, because you get very different answers. You're going to ask the CEO the answer to those questions, and then ask the person working on the factory floor, you get completely different perspectives on the same business, which are absolutely fascinating. And they're always completely in conflict. However good the business, they're always in conflict. And then you need to go and ask questions of the wider world. And the way to do this is to find a bunch of people who write about, think about, speak about, podcast about things that are relevant to you or that might be relevant to you. So yeah, go and find some great newsletters. And I know we're all a bit sick of, like, we get a billion emails, but find two or three really good ones that, you know, unsubscribe from all the rest. Find two or three really good ones that give you great nuggets. So I've just been reading one this morning. What's Ben's name? Benedict Evans. There we go. Benedict Evans's technology newsletter, right? Really good. Or Precede Now, actually. So Martin Bryant's email newsletter about the new tech startups that are coming through. Just full of great nuggets. It's even got a TLDR section at the front, which just tells you all you need to know about what new technologies, what new startups coming through, basically where the smart money is going. And just note things down over the course of 6 months. I keep a thing called Jotpad, which is just a Google Doc I have open all the time. Just note these things down. And then every 6 months, carve out a day, get all the things that people have complained about to you on one side. You can literally grab yourself a sheet of A4 and a biro, stick all those down one side, get all the trends you've seen across the top, and it doesn't matter, you can swap those around, it still works. And then you've got a grid, basically, of interesting pressures, things that people are complaining about, that are causing problems, that are basically pent-up demand for change, and then a bunch of things that might unlock that change down here. And wherever you see them connecting, going, oh, look, we've got a massive issue with skills shortages in software development, and we've got a whole new class of AI software coming through that's going to make software development much easier. Wait a minute. There's a really interesting connection here. We probably ought to be doing something about that.
Wow. And then I guess when you get there, do you ever find that people, when you're obviously invited in, but are you ever met with kind of resistance or reactant because the future is scary and people don't want to think about the future because that's a long, long way away? There are some forward thinkers.
All the time.
How do you combat that?
Look, I'm usually going into really large organizations. And yeah, if I can move the needle in an organization of that size, 0.1%, 0.25%, I mean, 0.5% would be amazing, right? It would be absolutely incredible. There are very few occasions in my 12-year professional futurism career where I've moved the needle more than that. You know, I know of one situation where I was directly, it wasn't just me, but I was one of the major contributors to them investing tens of millions of pounds in a completely new direction and buying companies and because they were making a bet on the future. It's very rare that I'm shifting the needle more than a few percent. But I think that's quite impressive for an individual going into a multi-billion-dollar company quite often. Yeah, that's quite satisfying for me. The resistance comes in all sorts of forms. Usually when you're brought in, you've got a sponsor. You know, there is someone in the executive team who said, we ought to get this person in to come and talk to us. And not everybody wants to listen to the person that's sponsored by that person. So you've got the sort of internal politics resistance. It doesn't matter who you are. They might not want to listen to you. Sometimes what you're saying is in direct conflict with what they've been saying, or actually it hurts their job role. So I came across a really interesting example working with the public sector where one of the criteria for which job title you had and therefore what perks, what pension, you know, what salary you got was directly tied to how many direct line reports you had. And we were, you know, one of my conclusions was that they really needed to split this team up. It just didn't make sense to have all of the people under that team because they were doing very different things. And so this person was, you know, diametrically opposed to me, not because he necessarily disagreed because he thought I was wrong, but because if they took my advice, he was going to be downgraded from a, you know, team leader to a manager or a manager to a team leader or a director to a manager or something. That's not my fault. That's just the weird way. Yeah, he was still doing basically the same job. It was just the way that the employment was structured. So you always bump into different types of resistance. And like I say, I'm just delighted if I can move the needle even a few fractions of a percent usually. But yeah, and occasionally those few case studies, which can never be case studies because they're always situations where if I'm working into a board, No one sees what I give them. No one sees what I tell them. This is private stuff. So I can never actually go and shout about the fact that these tens of millions of pounds were spent based on my advice. But yeah, every now and again, I'll take those small wins.
What can you tell us about things that you've spotted in businesses that have even surprised you that just weren't on the radar at all?
Oh, I mean, all sorts. Give some good examples. One company I went into and I spoke to one of the administrators in their procurement department. And she said to me, this was quite a long time ago now, and the company's changed a lot since, so I don't think they'll mind. She said to me, we've got a chasing culture here. Nothing gets done unless you pick up the phone. And I thought, that's interesting, because I've just come away from speaking to the operations director, and he was telling me all about this brilliant new software system they had that eliminated all of this. And you go and talk to a few more people and you realize that instead of the software system being used, people are bypassing it and there's lots of manual data re-entry, that actually no one trusts the software system. So everyone's still picking up the phone to make sure everything's happening. And all of these supposed efficiencies they were going to get by investing millions of pounds in this new software are not happening at all. But from the top down, they look completely the same. Another company I once went in and they let me go and speak to their customers. And I went to interview their biggest customer, and their biggest customer told me that they were leaving them. And I was sent to interview this customer as an example of a really happy customer. And I had to go back and tell the board that actually the salesperson had completely missed the decline of the relationship and their biggest customer was leaving them. That was pretty terrifying. But the single most terrifying thing I can find when I go in and do some consulting with the company is that everyone's really happy. If you go in and find that everyone's really happy, really comfortable, that people are joining as grads and staying there for 15 years, everyone's singing from the same hymn sheet, you know that there's probably something about to go really horribly wrong, because there's no one asking difficult questions. There's no one challenging. There's no one coming in with external experience and perspectives. If you go in and if you go into a company and find that everyone's really happy, there's probably a really nasty surprise just around the corner, and they're probably lying to themselves about it, which is sad to say, because we all want to work in really happy places, but you have to have a level of disruption and change and challenge in order to stay current.
One of the things that I picked up them from what you said, it feels like a lot of the people you speak to would rather adapt to a problem than go for change.
Yeah, hugely. I was doing some work recently and I came across, I can't remember the exact stats, but a bunch of executives were interviewed in 2005, and they would rather buy back shares, spend money buying back shares to sustain the share price over the short term, than spending money on infrastructure and skills to fix the business in the long term. And it was something like 60-70% of executives said they'd rather fix the short-term problem than fix the long-term problem. And I think it's kind of natural, right? Human beings are very short-termist. I'm writing a series for one of the national papers next year, and human beings are inherently short-termist, right? We've evolved over millions of years to deal with what's in front of us. It's how we stayed alive. We're worried about, where's our next meal coming from? Is that big cat going to eat me? What is this Bernie thing? Oh, it's fire. I can use it. We're not worried about the long term. And our long term thinking evolved much more recently. A lot of that sort of lizard brain stuff comes out in business in the day to day. Just firefighting, just keeping the business running is hard work, right? And so forcing yourself to step back and think about the future is not natural. It's not something we do very often, and actually it's not something we're incentivized to do either. Look at how we measure businesses on quarters and years. We don't measure business performance over 5 years and decades. We measure business performance in the short term, so there's no real incentive to do that long-term thinking, and there's a good argument, I think, that we have to change that we have to do something to change the incentives around business performance, because when you do align to the long term, actually, a lot of what become good business decisions are much better aligned with what would be seen as good ethical decisions as well. A lot of the worst stuff we've done over the last 50 years has been because we were chasing the next quarter or the next year's profits rather than thinking about where we'd be in 5 or 10 years. And if we think about where we'd be in 5 or 10 years, we'd probably have much, in the long term, more sustainably successful businesses.
It's so fascinating. And when you were talking there about businesses, I also think about like the individual. I really think like I'm a big fan of the Power of Now, and the message is don't worry about the future because it's just imagination, and don't think about the past. I guess how do we, for anyone listening to this that is probably like they've got to maybe a bit of a stoic mindset where they don't think about the future. Why are they wrong? Why should they be thinking, not from a like a business standpoint, but in their everyday life, why should they be thinking about the future?
The answer is because there was a long period where people argued that change was happening faster now. And it's not true, right? Everything, all change is not happening faster. I'm talking to you from a 140-year-old house, which is precisely as cold as it sounds. And it hasn't changed an awful lot in that time. And actually, the way we build houses hasn't changed an awful lot in that time. You know, houses still basically look like houses. Beds still look like beds. Toilets still flush basically the way they did 400 years ago, right? So not everything changes faster, but some things do. Like we have stripped all the friction from a lot of aspects of commerce and innovation. It's easier to design and build new things now. It's easier to bring new things to market now than it was. I mean, I tell you, I started my first business in 2005. It took me 6 weeks and 2 meetings just to get a bank account. You know, I had to work with my accountant to register a company on Companies House because there was no online registration. Like doing my accounts was a manual nightmare because there was no Xero or free agent or anything like that. There was Sage if you were lucky, and that was miserable back then. So, running a business was so much harder 20 years ago than it is now, and particularly founding a business and bringing new things to market. But actually bringing new ideas to market is much easier than it was now. Those ideas move much more quickly, and there are many more of them because of this lower friction. So the result is that if you are focused exclusively on the now, you are always going to be running to keep up. You are always going to be running to keep up. And particularly in business, we have this terrible habit where we set a direction. And because we're so focused on the now, we're so focused on the firefighting and keeping things running. And actually, we're focused on growth. We're focused on sales. You know, we're trying to hit those numbers, that we end up running into a wall. The analogy I came up with the other day is this. Like, imagine a business as a train, right? Once you've laid the tracks on day one, you set out what your business is going to be. You define your model. You build yourself your train tracks and a destination. The only control you've got after that is how fast or slow the train goes, right? You can speed the train up, you can chuck coal into the boiler, you can pull that lever, or you can stop it. The problem with that is, what if those rails are going to the wrong destination, right? What if the destination changes? You know, something new's come along, and you know what? The city that you were going to has gone bust because the gold ran out. You know, whatever it may be, unless you are thinking about that business in the long term, all you can do is go faster or slower, and eventually you're going to hit a destination that's dead. If you build a business as a truck, quite possibly smaller, less efficient, not as good for the environment, but a lot more maneuverable, and you stick a sat nav in it, you can do two things. One is, if the price of fish is better in Manchester than it is in Preston all of a sudden, you can go to Manchester Fish Market rather than Preston. You can constantly change your destination. And you know what? If fish goes out of fashion, you can start shipping vegan alternatives, right? Your truck is still valuable. But also you've got your sat-nav in front of you and you can reroute around obstacles. And this really maps to those two speeds of thinking about the future that I was talking about. You should always be thinking about the long term. Like, do that every few years. Go, are we actually heading in the right direction? But even more frequently, you need to be thinking about the short term, doing that horizon scanning, going, do you know what? If we don't change something in 6 months, we're probably going to get blown out of the water by X, Y, or Z. Let's do something about it now because we've seen it first before anybody else. And it is an unfair advantage. You know, that classic startup phrase, it is an unfair advantage simply because so few people do it. It's just not done very often.
I love the analogy. And from what you were saying there, obviously you've ran businesses through probably the biggest disruption of technology and AI. I guess when you think about the next 30, 50 years, what worries you?
I always tell people I'm a long-term optimist and a short-term pessimist. And the reason for that is the optimism comes from, I love human beings. I think we're bloody brilliant, right? Our entire species in many ways is defined by technology. Right? Rewind 3.5 million years and proto-humans are already making tools to butcher animals, right? Excuse me. We can't cure the common cold yet, but we can, you know, we can make an awful lot of tools and technology. So I have enormous faith in human beings to solve problems because it's what we do. But the near term, we've actually created an awful lot of problems that we have to get through first. You know, climate change is going to be a big issue. It's not a species killer. It's not going to wipe us out as a species, but it is going to put cities underwater. It is going to disrupt crop production. It is going to make water a scarce resource in places. It's going to kill people. It's going to right down to, you know, trivial things like changing where we go on holiday because it's just going to be too hot in some places we used to go. Yeah, we've got to deal with that. We've got all the tools to deal with it. Like, it's not like we don't know how to deal with it. And actually, the optimistic bit of me says we're actually dealing with it much faster than we ever have done. There's a brilliant newsletter by a woman called Hannah Ritchie about, I think it's called Sustainability by Numbers. And it's a much more practical, optimistic view of actually how fast we are tackling climate change. Not fast enough, but we are, you know, rolling out renewables. We are reducing emissions. We're doing lots of really interesting things. And even the stuff that looks terrible, she points out, isn't as bad as it looks. So the fact that they're still building coal-fired power plants in China at an enormous rate. Yes, they are. Are they ever going to turn those power plants on? Probably not. It's just that the centrally planned economy means that they can't just turn them off. They can't just stop building them. Otherwise, loads of people will be out of work. I'm scared about that. I think there's also the risk of that low friction world creates a load of other risks as well. Cybersecurity remains an enormous problem and is going to be a growing problem in the years ahead. And actually just health as well. We are an aging population. We are so globally interconnected that diseases spread very, very quickly now, as we prove with COVID. Are we likely to have another pandemic? Seems quite likely. You know, the tools to tackle it are much more advanced now. And it's not like we didn't foresee this one. You know, the World Health Organization had a working group called Pandemic X, or Disease X, I think it was a good working group, based on the idea that, well, not even the idea, the probability that there was going to be something like it in the none too distant future. Unfortunately, they just hadn't got to the point of fully resolving what we did about it yet. But they at least, you know, we knew this thing was coming. There's lots of things that scare me in the short term. But it's particularly from a business perspective, it's that volatility. It's the volatility of geopolitics. You know, it's the volatility of climate. It's the volatility of disease. But business thrives in times of certainty. And although, you know, volatility creates lots of opportunities, I think all of us would like to see a few stable years in the near future. That'd be very pleasant.
I saw a quote the other day, Tom, that said, "The future's here, it's just not evenly distributed."
William Gibson, yeah.
What does that mean to you?
It's a really interesting quote because we see it all the time. I mean, partly you can see it in your own home, right? Because so many of our homes are sort of pastiches of technology from 100 years, a lot of us. Like, mine's a great example. Yeah, I'm sat here in this house was built in the 1870s. I've got a double glazed window in front of me. I've got LED lights around me. And I'm surrounded, you know, behind me, I've got a super sophisticated 3D printer that can turn my ideas into products in the space of minutes. You know, that's an incredible level of uneven distribution. The fact that the infrastructure of our world is largely quite old, it's decades old, but the stuff we carry in our pockets is, you know, bang up to date. But it's also, it's true geographically as well. If you look at the, I was in Shanghai in May for a conference where, you know, most of the cars on the road are electric, and not just the cars, but actually all the personal vehicles as well. And so you know, Shanghai was famously used to be very polluted, very noisy, you know, really hectic city. It's really quiet. Like it's quite scarily quiet. You know, to the point where it's quite easy to get run over because all of the, what used to be these little two-stroke scooters with people's entire lives on them and now little electric scooters with people's entire lives crammed on, like whole families on one electric scooter, you know, hanging off the sides. And if you take a step out without looking, you're likely to get wiped out by this thing because it's completely silent. And so, yeah, they're way ahead of us in terms of the electric vehicle transition. But go to other parts of China, it's completely different. You know, go to more like Vietnam, where the energy infrastructure is just not there. And again, it's, you know, it's completely different. So, yeah, you know, it's, we have the possibility to live a very, very science fiction lifestyle. Like if you, you know, go back to this book and the things that it imagined, right? You know, we're living in the future. There's a great vignette in here. Let me see if we can find it. Of the future home, and you'll recognize absolutely everything. Here we go. A house of the future, right? Electric car out the front, solar panels on the roof, right? That's my house. I mean, it's not my house because it's American and it's, you know, it's made of cardboard, but it's, you know, I've got a few kilowatts of solar panels on the roof. I've got 11 kilowatts of batteries to my right. I've got my homemade EV charging out the front. You know, it's, I'm living in the future that was defined in 1979, but most of my street isn't.
Wow. Amazing. What do you think is the reality of AI over the next 10 years? What have you spotted?
There was a really, really good article by a guy called Ed Zitron yesterday, I think. And he's a deep, deep AI skeptic and has been vocally AI skeptic for some time. And I sit somewhere between him and the cheerleaders, probably more towards his end, but a little bit of the cheerleader as well. In that, it's a tool, right? It's a tool like any other. It has limitations like any other tool. And particularly when we talk about AI, we're talking about the transformer-based generative AI, which is the stuff we've all become familiar with the last few years. So ChatGPT, Stable Diffusion, you know, image generators, video generators, text generators. And you know, the limitation of these technologies is that they're based on training data. So you feed them a load of stuff, and rather than regurgitating that stuff, they try and feed you back stuff that looks like it. Feed it a million press releases, it'll write you a press release. Feed it a million sales emails, it'll write you a pretty good sales email. The problem is it's got no concept of whether what it feeds you is true or not. It doesn't really have a concept of true, just that old Stephen Colbert word, truthiness. Like it has that, it feels true even if it isn't. And so you get these weird hallucinations. My favorite two examples of the hallucinations of the last year. One is the famous story of the two US attorneys who were fined, for contempt of court by a judge because they brought examples of prior judgments, so precedents to a court case that didn't exist. They used ChatGPT as a search engine and ChatGPT had entirely fabricated these previous trials and these previous cases that these two presented to a judge as fact. And he was therefore rather critical of them for doing this. The other one comes from the travel industry. Someone tried to create a GPT-based travel advisor. And someone was trying to get doing like a driving tour of the East Coast of the US. I think it was the East Coast. They put a load of parameters in. I want to go to these places. I want to take this long and, you know, da, 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 da. In order to make their ideal itinerary work, it hallucinated two entire cities, and put them on their itinerary. So, you know, there are fundamental limitations with this technology. But more fundamental is that they can never do anything original. They can only do pastiche. And I think human beings are quite sensitive to that over time. Like, we'll accept pastiche up to a point, but ultimately we really want stuff that's original and high quality and done by somebody's brain. And so I think, you know, two different companies have tried to pitch me creating a video avatar of myself so I can do keynotes. My video avatar can do keynotes. I just feed it a script and it delivers it. It's like, no, like people want me with all my flaws and my colds and my stuffed up nose. They want to know they've had the real Tom Cheesewright experience rather than some perfectly, you know, sort of pixel brushed version of me with no real emotion or intonation and no, you know, none of the sort of the in the moment aspects of it. So I think it's a very powerful tool. AI agents particularly are going to be great next year for automating the boring stuff, the stuff we don't want to do. I think it'll be integrated into all our software and it'll make a nicer interface. So things like, you know, one of the big skills gaps in enterprise at the moment is financial planning and analysis. Like people who can actually look at numbers and then give you an answer in a human form. They can do the number crunching and then go, this means that we ought to do X, Y, or Z. Right, we don't have enough people who can do that. AI is pretty good at that stuff, right? You know, you can have a conversational interface to your financial accounts to go, what does the trend look like for sales of, you know, peanuts in the next 6 months, and should we be investing in peanut futures? And it can go, yeah, do you know what the trend's been up? You know, it's fairly on season. It's been up about, you know, 1.5% the last three quarters. But if we, you know, if it maps to last year's trend, it's going to be up 5%. So buying some peanut futures now probably a good idea, right? So we can do that sort of stuff. The other thing that's interesting is so-called RAGs. So retrieval augmented generators. So this is where you use the conversational capability of a GPT, of an AI sort of engine, but actually allow it to access real information, particularly real-time information. And so I think those are really like a powerful idea for, because the thing about AI interfaces is the information in them is inherently old, like because it's all training data that's been collected over a period of time. Once you've trained the AI, that data starts aging. Whereas with a RAG, you've got real time data plus that cool chatty humanoid feels real interface, and that's a cool area of technology. So it'll be in everything next year. It's really useful. It can automate a lot of the crap we don't want to do. But look, it's not going to take over the world. It's not going to, you know, it's not going to be Arnie anytime soon in Terminator. It's not got that capability. There are fundamental limitations to what the Transformer architecture can do.
You've made me feel confident now. I can sleep at night. Tom, I knew this was going to be a brilliant conversation. You've got a new book out. Tell me about that.
So I showed you the book that inspired me. And a few years after I started the blog, I actually wrote to Usborne, the publisher of that book. And I said, this book inspired me and loads of people I know. I think it's time for a new one and you should let me write it. And they wrote me back a lovely email that said, no. They said, we don't think there's a market for it. And even if we did, we don't work with in-house authors. We don't work with any external authors. We only work with our own in-house authors. I was like, well, that's, at least it was a nice email. Fair enough. 10 years later, middle of lockdown, I'm on the only sort of holiday you could do at the time, hiding away in a cottage in Northumberland. And as I get this tiniest bit of phone signal, my phone beeps, and it's an email from Usborne. And it's the guy who was basically... sorry, Alex, but basically with a postboy, as far as I can tell, when my original email came in. Like, he read my email first. He was an editorial assistant, I think. Now a full-blown editor with a long history, you know, quite senior in the organization, has kept my email, remembered it, followed my career, and convinced the publisher that now's the time to do a new one. So he's emailing. We have a very excited chat, which ends up with me dancing around the kitchen of this little cottage, saying, wow, would you like to write the new book of the future? And so... 14 years later, it takes a while to get these things out the door, See Inside the Future comes out. So this is a lift the flaps book with a guide to, you know, all sorts of different aspects of the future, like space, inside your own body, like what the future of medicine and travel and transport looks like, all with like these lift the flaps with loads of detail. And yeah, it came out in October. The reception has been better than I could possibly have imagined. My favorite thing to receive these days is messages from mates who've bought it for their kids, and it's their kids just engrossed in the book, like deep in the book. One friend even texted me the other day to say, funny one, my son and my nephew would really like to meet you and ask you some questions about the book. Could you come and meet up with us for a coffee and answer their questions? So I went to meet with them and got peppered with questions by like a 4-year-old and a 9-year-old about the book and all the different aspects of it. It was brilliant. absolutely brilliant. So yeah, it's been a huge thrill, and it's out there now, and it's selling pretty well, which is nice.
I love that, and that story is amazing. That's one of those. I bet you couldn't have predicted that for the future.
No, do you know when they said no, I sort of wrote that off. It was like, okay, nice try, but you just have to crack on your own. But it's something I've always wanted to do for a long, long time. So to have it out there and to have the reception that it's got has just been it's been wonderful. It's really wonderful.
A real full circle moment. Yeah. Tom, I love this conversation. Thank you so much for joining us. I feel like I could talk to you all day and throw questions at you. If people are listening and they want to work with you, they want to check you out. I know that you do a lot of keynotes and public talking, and you've also got businesses that you're running. Where can people find you? What should they get in touch with you for?
So they have the advantage of a very unusual name. So Tom Cheesewright, stick that into Google. Last time I checked, I was the first 13 pages of results. Stick Tom Cheesewright in. You'll find tomcheesewright.com, and there's loads of ways to contact me there. Or just hit me up on LinkedIn. I'm pretty visible there with a fairly good network going on. So, yeah, come find me, say hello, and, yeah, I'd love to work with you. I'm trying to do things a bit differently this time around. I have a terrible habit of just saying yes to everything. I'm trying to be a bit more strategic for 2025. So if anybody wants to have a chat, between now and Christmas, or actually post you into January about 2025 and beyond, then I'd love to have a half hour chat with you and talk to you about the ways maybe I can help.
Amazing. Thank you so much, Tom.
My pleasure. Thanks, Tom. Jack. Really enjoyed it. And cheers, Zach.